Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, March 26th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. First, a little bit of house cleaning, a little bit of internal business here at Studio 2. I just want to note that our third birthday is on Saturday.
I can't believe it.
So if you were planning to send a cake or flowers, and I know a lot of you were, wait until Monday when we're back in the office. We don't want that cake or that beautiful bouquet to go bad. So that's just a note for all of you listening out there.
3 years.
Now let's get into the topic of today's show, why you've been listening for 3 years. Great topics like ransomware. You know what ransomware is, probably vaguely. This is when hackers break into a system, an IT system, hold a lot of data hostage, and then demand a payment in return. It has proliferated greatly over the years, although you probably don't hear a lot about it because people have an incentive to be very hush-hush about ransomware attacks. Well, no hush-hush today. We're going to talk all about it. Two really great guests, one who's an expert on ransomware and has a book coming out, I think, in a week or two about this topic. And we're also going to talk to a ransomware negotiator. Yes, that is a job now. People who liaise between companies that have been hacked and criminal networks. So we're going to get some of those details about how ransomware works, how payment works, and what you should do if you find yourself in this position. Perhaps you have, and that goes to our question of the day. Have you ever been a victim of a ransomware attack, maybe somewhere you work? What concerns you about cyber attacks? What questions do you have for our experts? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And Avi, you know it's a thing when there's a whole job built around
it.
I mean, they got agencies now. They got companies that do this because that's how many people are getting hacked. Would love to get your thoughts on this. What concerns do you have? If you have questions, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And I said at the beginning of the show, it is Thursday.
What does that mean?
It's DJ of the day. So that means you get to be our DJ by choosing a song that is related to the topic of today's show. I would say songs about technology, being under attack, fighting back, being at war, something like that.
If you could find a song specifically about ransomware, I would be very, very impressed.
I was like, what could be about this? But if you have something in your mind,
be creative.
Email us by 12:30 today, studio2@whyy.org. And EP Kevin will make a decision, and you could be our DJ of the day.
But he has no say in our trio of local news stories, and that is where we start.
Yes.
Cherry, go ahead.
Yeah, Philadelphia TSA workers are being deployed to overstressed airports in other cities, just as ICE agents are showing up at Philadelphia International Airport. The Philadelphia Inquirer is reporting that at least four Philly TSA workers were sent to Houston Hobby Airport, where 40% of their TSA workforce is called out. They are seeing extremely long lines and wait times there in Houston. It's also reported that two Philly TSA employees were sent to Arizona. Now, our call out of TSA workforce has been about 20% in Philadelphia. That's why we haven't really felt the extremely long lines yet. But ICE agents were deployed to Philly this week, and they are now going through training from TSA workers on how to check IDs so that they can help at security checkpoints here. But some TSA workers have said that that is a slap in the face because ICE personnel, they are being paid every couple of weeks through allocations from the Big Beautiful Bill. Meanwhile, TSA workers continue to work with no pay.
We talked about this before the show, but it's such a strange scenario. It's like the snake eating its tail. I mean, the reason why DHS is not being funded fully, why TSA workers are not getting their check, is because of objections to ICE.
Yes.
Among Democrats, mostly. And as a result of that, ICE personnel are being deployed to airports to supposedly help the TSA workers. It just feels like quite a big quagmire.
And then, you know, we have a lot of Philadelphia and local officials and union officials calling for ICE to leave the Philadelphia airport, claiming it has led to fear and unsafe conditions. And by the way, this is one thing. There are a lot of questions because TSA workers undergo months of training before they are allowed to work those security checkpoints. and you have ICE agents who are not necessarily trained mm-hmm. in doing the TSA work, and now they're getting some training, but of course not the extensive training of TSA workers. And people are wondering, if you start putting them on the security checkpoint lines, will we all be less safe because they don't have as much training?
That's lots of questions. Question. Fair question. So, story number two, we just got a new round of estimate data from the U.S. Census Bureau, which is providing some more clarity on population trends in our region. Always interesting to take a look at the population trends, because they tell you, you know, maybe the story of your city and your area. A couple good analysis pieces that we noted, one in the Inquirer, one in the Philadelphia Business Journal mm-hmm. today. The Inky kind of focused a lot on city data. The top line takeaway is this: Philly added population last year, but only barely, and we're still below our pre-pandemic population of 1.6 million people. If you look under the hood, that's where it gets a little bit more interesting. Mm-hmm. Immigration to Philadelphia is down. That's not a surprise. We got about 7,000 new people from abroad last year. That number used to be around 17 or 18,000 a year. So that's a big drop. However, when you look at domestic migration, that's movement within the country, Philly seems to be retaining more people than before. We're still a net loser when it comes to domestic migration, but we're not losing as many people as we had in the past. So what does that mean exactly? You could draw lots of conclusions, some of them more positive than negative, but it's something to note. And then when you look at the region as a whole, 6.3 million beautiful people live in the Delaware gorgeous. Valley, all gorgeous. Of them gorgeous. Mm-hmm. We're the ninth largest region in the country. We're getting closer to eighth, though, as the Business Journal pointed out, because Miami is declining a bit, the Miami area. So that's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, very interesting story. I noticed that we are not the outlier, because growth slowed in 380 of the 387 metro areas in the country.
Yes.
And the main areas of growth were in Texas and Arizona, but most of the Northeast metro areas on the map had less than 2% population growth. So yep. we're right in there.
We're right there in the heart of the curve, absolutely. Within the region, by the way, one of the fastest growing areas is South Jersey. Mm-hmm. The South Jersey suburbs. We're also seeing some pretty significant growth in Chester County. Delaware County, Bucks County actually lost a little bit of population last year. So there's always little micro trends within the macro trend. I think the macro trend for the region is more or less stable, sort of slightly growing.
Yeah, so interesting. And by the way, we got to think about workforce, what that means if we have less
Absolutely.
People from outside the country come in.
Oh, it's a huge deal.
We talked about healthcare, all those things, yep. and home healthcare. A lot of folks... immigrants work in those spaces.
Absolutely. So third story is going to be a palate cleanser here. Go ahead, Jerry.
So if you need some good news, a SEPTA regional rail conductor is providing his passengers with inspirational messages. Take a look, listen.
Please remember, the things we want out of this world are the things we have to put into the world. If you want courtesy, you have to be courteous. If you want kindness, you have to be kind. If you want to be understood, you have to have understanding. Folks, do everything you can to accomplish these goals. Everyone, have a wonderful, wonderful day, and we will see you tomorrow. Next stop, Jefferson.
Next stop, Jefferson. Right back to work.
Next stop, Jefferson. Took you right back to reality with that.
I know, that's right. Shout out to Casey McKillen, who posted this on TikTok with the message, train conductor or life coach, thank you, SEPTA. And to me, the message is you get what you give.
You get what you give.
Yeah, what a great message about karma.
Yeah.
You know, and I was thinking about, you know, I smile a lot because I want people to smile back at me, you know. And so it's like a lot of things. You get what you give.
I loved it. I loved every second of it. I especially loved the ending, Next Stop Jefferson. It's like, you know, a great spiritual leader was reincarnated as a train conductor.
I love it. Okay, and sometimes that's when you need it on the train.
Absolutely. And I think I would let this guy go even further with it. I don't know who he is, but, you know, let him play a little music.
Yeah.
Really lean into it.
A little 30-second meditation before you get to Jefferson stop.
Then you got to get off at Jefferson, sadly.
I know.
Do you remember the song, You Get What You Give?
Sing it for me. I know.
Oh, I'm just singing it. Like, don't let go. You got the music in you.
Love it.
It's from the 90s. It was a big hit. The New Radicals, by the way. He should be able to play that song a little bit, you know.
And get us all,
A little music, mood setting underneath the message.
I love
it. More train conductors should be like this.
And by the way, I got a shout out. Philly has some amazing SEPTA conductors. If you Google inspiring SEPTA conductors, because we tried to track this guy down, a bunch of names pop up.
Yeah, but not this guy.
Not this guy.
Does anyone know who this guy is? Can we find him? That would be fantastic.
Yeah, because...
Does he do this all the time?
Or was this just a one-off? Special day? I don't know.
Yeah, please reach out to studio2@whyy.org. Or if you're sending that cake I mentioned at the top of the segment, you could go ahead and leave a note about the train conductor as well.
Just say happy birthday, Studio 2. Yes. But we're going to be talking about cyber crimes and specifically ransomware attacks. We'd love to hear
those
from you.
Those people are less nice than the conductor.
Yeah. What concerns about cyber attacks do you have? Have you been a victim? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org.
You made me sing on the air.
We'll be right back.
That was messed up, by the way.
Hey, put you on the spot. You did great.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. For fans of The Pitt, you might have been scratching your head at one of the more dramatic plot lines this season. Hackers break into a neighboring hospital, hold critical medical data for ransom, and create chaos for the doctors and the nurses.
Well, as it turns out, this is probably more realistic than you'd think. Ransomware attacks are on the rise. One research institute reported that ransomware victims are increasing 58% year over year as of 2025. They're targeting health systems, corporations large and small, and government institutions and utilities. So today, we're diving deep into the world of cybercrime to unpack this troubling trend.
And joining us, we have Mark Lance, ransomware negotiator at GuidePoint Security, with over 20 years of experience working with Fortune 500 companies. Mark, welcome to Studio 2.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let me also welcome Anya Shortland, who is a professor at King's College London and author of a new book, Dark Screens: Hackers and Heroes in the Shadowy World of Ransomware. Anya, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes.
To be.
Yes. We're so happy to have you. And for our listeners at home, on the road and elsewhere, what concerns you about cyber attacks? Have you been a victim? And what questions do you have for our experts? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on Facebook and YouTube, you can put your comments in the chat.
Anya, I wanted to do a brief history of ransomware with you as we get going in this conversation. So am I understanding this correctly, that the first ransomware attack was by a disgruntled medical researcher? Is that right? Can you take us back to the early days of ransomware and how it got started?
That is indeed right. This was 1989, and it was a slightly odd attack. It was, at the time, there was not much of an internet, and the first ransomware attack was pretty much a sort of buggy and horse type thing with a floppy disk.
Floppy disks! Oh my gosh.
Floppy disk. It was sent off to 20,000 people in the hope that they would insert this piece of malware into their computer. The point of it was mostly AIDS education. Mm-hmm. So what he was trying to do was to tell people, be careful where you put your thing. Don't put something like this into your computer. You don't know where it's been. It was masked as an AIDS questionnaire. And quite a lot of people fell for it, particularly in the AIDS research community. So it wasn't a money spinner. He was caught very quickly indeed. In terms of a proof of concept, it was a proof that quite a lot of work needed to be done to make this into a crime that paid.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so then it did evolve into a crime that paid. And it sounds like about 10 to a dozen years ago, there were some technological leaps that created the possibility of like larger scale ransomware attacks and made it so criminals had an interest in really trying to scale and professionalize this. So can you just break down briefly some of the technological changes that really enabled ransomware to go viral?
Yeah, so the first thing that was needed was an internet that was not designed around security, but around making communication as frictionless as possible.
Yeah.
The second really important piece of kit was the Tor protocol, which allows people to communicate with each other just using pseudonyms, handles, nicknames, and hide their identity. The third piece was asymmetric encryption. The first piece of ransomware had just one encryption protocol, and one decryption protocol could help every single victim. With asymmetric encryption, everyone has to solve a really difficult puzzle.
Mm-mm.
And the final thing, and that only came to pass in 2013, was cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin, which provides a payments mechanism that allows the criminals to stay hidden. Again, stay hidden behind pseudonyms, but nonetheless very, very difficult to track. And those were all the things that the first creator of ransomware did not have, but in 2013 it all came together with CryptoLocker. And it so happened that hospitals were one of the first group of victims.
Yeah, and I want to just remind our callers that we'd love to get your concerns about cyber attacks. Have you been a victim? And what questions do you have for our experts? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We have Chuck from New Jersey on the line. We're bringing a caller. Chuck, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. So I worked about 8 years ago for a company, a consumer electronics company, and we suffered a ransomware attack. You know, basically, I think it was sort of at the time when we were starting to work from home. Some of us were considered essential, but around that early 2020 COVID time, and no one's computer worked one morning. So anyway, the word at the time was that it's illegal to deal with these people who violate these attacks because it's seen as dealing with terrorists or kidnap or something like that.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like, my understanding was that it's like a gray area. They had to hire some kind of special law firm to avoid, you know, culpability or whatever, to get the company running again. So I'm wondering what you can tell us about like a situation like that.
Yeah. Chuck from New Jersey, perfect time to bring Mark into the conversation. Mark, so I want you to, for folks who may not be tech savvy, I want you to first explain what ransomware is, and then take us to the day you get a call from a company like the one Chuck worked at, and explain sort of what happens when one of these ransomware attacks happen.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of complexity involved with this stuff. And I mean, I think to your point, like, let's understand what modern ransomware is. And it's when somebody gains access to a system, they encrypt that system, and they want you to pay in order to get access back to your system or back to your data. And that was, like, again, another way when we talked about the evolution of ransomware and kind of how we got to where we are now, is it used to be very targeted at like individuals, where you would, you know, hit as many people as you could, hoping that they'd each individually pay to get access back to their systems. But then they realized, oh, you know who has more, you know, funding and potential to pay a ransom is organizations. And so they start targeting organizations. And so organizations then make these adjustments in these ways that they're sophisticating themselves or maturing themselves so that they can't be impacted. Well, where modern ransomware has gone is it's no longer just about like knocking out the system and making sure that the system is inaccessible. That's one way they're trying to get you to pay the ransom. But modern ransomware, they're also stealing your information, what they believe to be like sensitive or private information from the environment. And even if you're able to recover all your systems and get back to regular operations, they're going to say, you know what, we're going to release all this information publicly if you don't pay us. And so that's where they've evolved and they've transformed into this, you know, targeting of, you know, certain verticals or industries and trying to optimize their potential for getting paid. So even if you're able to restore operationally, they're still going to try to get you to pay by leaking your data. And then so, yeah, that's where we would get engaged. And a lot of times to the question is like, you know, what can you do about that? I think historically the FBI would be like, no, don't ever pay a ransom payment. Yeah. But I think with modern ransomware, there might be instances based on how, you know, critical or how, you know, impacted your business is that you might have to make that consideration just to recover.
And Mark, I want you to kind of explain to people because, you know, do you go to work one day and your computer has like, you know, cross skull and crossbones on it, or what happens? Like, how do you even know you've been attacked?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Like, you see a lot of different ways, but I would say the most common that you're going to see is people are going to show up. Certain systems are going to be inaccessible, or like you're trying to get to certain files. There's going to be a ransom note on your desktop. And within that ransom note, typically it says you've been impacted by whatever group that is responsible for this, whatever cyber criminal gang, and that don't mess with any of your files or else you might not be able to decrypt them later, but then get in touch with us or have somebody from your team get in touch with us via our communication dark web site. So go download this specific type of browser and go to this specific site where then you can communicate with us and we can talk you through how to address this. But we've also seen in the past where, you know, they're printing out ransom notes on printers within the office environment. They're cold calling and picking up the phone to the senior leadership team and saying, hey, you've been impacted by this. You know, we need to have a conversation, follow these instructions. But more common than not, it is that ransom note shows up on your system. And, you know, that's when you need to engage the experts to understand, like, hey, what should we be doing at this point?
And Mark, how do they get into the system typically? Mm-hmm. Because, like, we all do IT training and we're all told about, like, don't click on this link, don't click on this email, which makes it feel like it's some individual who has access to the system, some employee who clicks on the wrong thing. Is that typically how it happens?
It certainly can be. I mean, when you look at kind of the method of ingress is what we cause, or the root cause of how an attacker got into the environment, I get questions all the time, like, could somebody, like, I've got my work computer set up at home. Could somebody weaponize a binary on my personal computer, transfer that over to my work computer because I left the VPN up, you know, upload it there? And it's like, yeah, you could do all that, but, you know, why get all Hollywood? You know what still works? getting people to click on an email link.
Yeah.
Or getting people to go to a specific website.
Yeah.
Yeah. The basic stuff still works. So, like, it's people who bad hygiene, they haven't patched their systems. You get people to visit or click on a link or open a file. A lot of times these multi-million dollar response efforts are associated with a single person who's actually clicked on an email.
Wow. And so Anya, tell us, who are these people? Because Mark is describing some sketchy situations. Your phone ringing, somebody's on the other line. You got the little note on your computer. Everybody's seeing this. Like,
feels like a movie.
It doesn't even feel real. And you don't even know it's true. And then you're supposed to go to the dark web? Like, who are these people?
It's really interesting. So they're effectively internet startups. Quite a lot of them based in Russia, where extortion and data theft is not a crime as long as it's directed at Western countries. And they're proper firms. Some of them even have an office location. They have various departments. They've got malware specialists. They've got finance specialists. They've got human resources. Considering what they're doing, relatively well organized. I mean, they are internet startups, so not always brilliant at everything. some of their chats have been leaked, and so we do know quite a lot about them. They tend to be relatively short-lived. They trade on having a reputation, so reputation is valuable because people like Mark will only deal with ransomware brands that have a track record of actually delivering decryption keys that work, of not releasing the data that they've stolen and have been paid to not release. But on the other hand, of course, if you are an an internet firm that victimizes people, and you do so egregiously, eventually the FBI and the world's police forces will get in touch with you and shut down your server, etc. And then these firms just disband and pop up again with the same kind of malware.
Whack-a-mole.
So, okay, so these are sort of semi-professional outfits. I mean, how profitable are they, Anya? I mean, you know, and how much kind of phishing do they have to do to get a reasonable, like, return on investment? I'm putting that in air quotes. But, yeah, how much money are these folks making?
Well, they're different business ideas. One of them is that you do everything in-house and you hire your attack teams. And if you want to do something sophisticated, then that's probably what you will do. The other business model is that you just hire affiliates, and the affiliates do the phishing. They get the access into a company, and then the ransomware gang takes over with their malware. And who does the negotiation could either be the affiliate or somebody within the ransomware gang. If you were on the sort of coal face of crime and you're getting the access, you can negotiate up to 90% off the ransoms. Mm. But ransoms can be really substantial. So $1 million, $2 million, $4 million, $8 million. If you can really hold a major company to ransom that doesn't have an alternative to paying, and you're right. The FBI always says, don't pay. This is not a problem we should be using, solving by throwing money at it. If you've got people on life support, is not something that you really want to consider. This is a threat to life. This is a threat to public health. It can be a threat to public infrastructure. I don't know whether anyone still remembers Colonial Pipeline.
Major oil pipeline.
Yes, people do pay ransoms, and if you're a ransom negotiator, negotiating over the return of a person or of a painting, then you've got time. But if companies are hemorrhaging money and patients and customers and students and pupils, services to resume, then this is not a luxury where you say, okay, well, if we have the data back after Easter, that's fine.
Yeah.
Time is of the essence.
Time is of the essence. And Mark, I want you to, because I see your head nodding, and you've negotiated some of these ransoms in the past. Tell us, you know, from your perspective, as you're working through, you're representing a company, for example, and you're having to deal with and communicate with these entities, these organized entities. Clearly, these are highly intelligent, highly skilled people if they're able to execute this. What is that negotiation like? And walk us through an example.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it does vary because we do have to look at the history and the background of what we know about this specific threat group. But most importantly, and really the first step for us when we're engaging to help our customers and who are the victims of these attacks is, like, they need to understand, you know, potentially what's going on. And it's our responsibility to kind of educate them on what to expect. Mm-hmm. And so immediately it's like, you've got that ransom note. What we can do is, like, we can make initial contact to let them know, like, hey, we are being attentive. We've heard that we're under ransom. A lot of times they're going to give you, like, hey, this has to be paid within 48 hours or else, you know, we're going to publish your information. Typically, those timelines are off the table, honestly. If they think that they have the potential to make some money, then you can extend those timelines. And what the client needs to be doing at that point in time is understanding their business impact. Do we have access to be able to restore our systems? What data did they potentially steal? Do we know how they got into that environment? And so what we're doing is we're establishing a strategy with the victim to say, okay, well, do you have a potential appetite to pay the ransom? Right now, are we just delaying? But regardless of whether there's any intent to pay, there's other information we can get and glean from those conversations, like access to a file tree that they'll use for, like, proof that we stole information, which we can share over to a forensics team that can then use that to say, oh, well, we know these are the systems that were likely impacted. We can use delay techniques so that they can go perform that business impact analysis. And then when we get to a point where it's like, we might, there might be a necessity or an appetite to pay the ransom, we're going to do things like proof of life, which is essentially proof of decryption. Like, we're going to give you three sample files. You show us that you can actually decrypt those files, and then we believe you actually have the tools that would be needed to help us decrypt our environment.
Because I was going to ask, how do you know that they're telling the truth? So how do you know that they're going to give you your data back? How do you know they're not going to publish data they said they wouldn't publish as part of the terms of the exchange? Like, how often, Mark, are they lying? Like, does it happen a lot?
Well, so like Anya said, these groups, we were tracking last year 75 different groups. This year, or the prior year, by the end of the year, we're tracking 124 different groups, because this is extremely lucrative for these cyber criminals. They're making a ton of money off of this. So this isn't anything that's going anywhere. But, you know, ultimately, what they have is they have a brand and a reputation to uphold. And if you look at what their primary motivator is, it's to make money.
Yep.
So at the end of the day, say we negotiate with them and we establish, all right, as part of this, if we pay you, you're going to give us access to a decryptor. You're going to confirm that you deleted our data, and you're going to tell us how you got into the environment so that we can do due diligence to confirm that. If we then pay them and they don't follow through with that, well, they're going to get a black eye, and it's going to establish some bad reputation. So maybe a group like, you know, Keelan is the specific cyber criminal group or gang that's done this. Like, now they have a reputation like, hey, we paid them and they weren't able to decrypt our systems. People are going to stop paying them.
Yeah.
And then now they're not monetizing their efforts. It's bad business. Next thing you know, they have to go down, start over, rebrand, come back as another group, and reestablish a new reputation. So we've actually seen where they will actually try to make sure they follow through.
They have an incentive,
And let me just talk about this, think this through. Like, so if you say, you know, I've read that paying them is the wrong thing to do, but, you know, if you're a company, you're trying to weigh, and Anya was going through some of the many things you have to consider, what are some of the things you would say, you know what, we have no choice, we do have to pay?
Yeah. So it's our responsibilities where we really say we're trying to educate clients on like, hey, here's what potentially could happen. But then they need to make the business decision and justification on whether they want to pay. Now, that being said, there's a multitude of reasons that we've seen people consider payment in the past. One, they don't have access to, you know, backups, or they're not able to get, you know, able to recover critical systems. Two, specifically associated with healthcare. We had one where they didn't have access to that, but they had access to cold storage. It was going to take them 2 weeks to get access to their backups, and they were losing $1 million a day. So over 2 weeks, that's $14 million. The ransom demand was $2 million, and they could start potentially doing some of that decryption within the span of 2 to 3 days. So it was more cost effective for them in that instance to actually think about making the ransom payment. Then there's other things like necessity to recover as quickly as possible, that's not monetarily driven. It could be, we've seen some people who pay for data suppression because maybe their intellectual property got stolen and they're scared that's going to be released out on the dark web. Well, they just don't want that floating out there easily accessible to anybody. So they're paying just to not have information published online. And those are just some of the reasons that businesses might justify the necessity to make a payment.
Yeah, and I see you wanted to chime in there, Anya, but we are coming up on a break, and we also have a caller, Matthew from Belmar. I want you to hang on the line. That looks like an interesting call.
Yeah, for sure.
So we're about to get to a break. Let me read in a comment from James, who says, I have wondered, as this issue has grown to touch more and more everyday people, if there is anything the government can do to protect our information, and if so, why don't they do it? We're going to talk about that on the other side of the break.
Yeah.
And I also want to get this perspective in from Stan, who says, here's a word of advice from someone who's been in the trenches in this area for decades. Private individuals who care about being as safe as possible from cyber attacks should use Apple equipment. That's Stan's perspective. Maybe we'll fact check that as well on the other side of this break. Again, our question today, what concerns do you have about cyber attacks? Have you been a victim? And what questions do you have for our experts? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Streaming on YouTube or Facebook. Drop a comment in the chat, and we will be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarant.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about the rise of ransomware attacks this hour when hackers hold a company's networks hostage and demand payment to unlock them. We're seeing more of these incidents on both large and small companies and growing concerns about national security risks if hackers go after essential infrastructure and utilities. So let me reintroduce our guests. We have Anya Shortland, professor at King's College London and author of the forthcoming book, Dark Screens, Hackers and Heroes in the Shadowy World of Ransomware, and Mark Lance, a ransomware negotiator at Guy Point Security.
And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What concerns you about cyber attacks? Have you been a victim? What questions do you have for our experts? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. And let's bring in a caller. I teased this before the break. Matthew from Belmar, New Jersey is on the line with a question. Matthew, how you doing?
Hey, doing well. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate you taking my call. I'm a network security engineer, and I've worked in a variety of verticals and different size companies. And my question for the guest is, for companies that can't have people like me on staff or can afford to pay ransomware, what's your recommendation to help them through this or to prevent it in the first place? You know, not everyone can afford an information security team, a network security guy, a network. You know, it's a very complex situation, and it evolves on a daily basis, you know. So yeah. What do you guys recommend for the smaller or medium businesses out there trying to work through this?
Thanks,
love
Matthew.
That question, Matthew. Yeah. Anya, do you want to take a crack at that? Because it's an interesting dynamic, right? Because if you're looking for the biggest payment, you would think you go after the biggest company, right? But those companies are also probably going to have the most sophisticated defenses. So are smaller, medium businesses and organizations often victimized? And if so, like, what could they do, Anya?
Well, they certainly are, because a lot of these attacks are not that well targeted. Yes, there are some groups that go in for what is called big game hunting, but actually it is also quite profitable to go for law firms, dental surgeries, doctor's surgeries. So, yes, small, medium-sized businesses are under attack as well. Some of them get insurance, so that is one way of accessing a whole suite of services. So that's my specialism, the ecosystem that helps people deal with ransomware attacks. There are also some pretty shady providers that offer ransomware decryption, mostly by going straight to the attacker. So you get the happy feeling that you've avoided paying the attacker, but you just pay a multiple to a ransomware payment mill. So that might not be the best idea. There is some help from government as well. Mm-hmm. So you're not entirely on your own. There is guidance of how you can curate your response. But it is really difficult, which is why we see this ecosystem that bridges the gap between the legal entities and the criminal underworld. That's why we have insurance, because curating a response under time pressure and under financial pressure is so difficult.
Yeah.
And Mark, I wanted to ask you, because I got very interested in this target, because this issue, because I learned that New Jersey had signed on as a statewide member of the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center, which was supposed to help people to the extent that they, or help agencies and you know, that got hacked or whatever and had malware attackers. And a lot of folks didn't even know about that. School districts didn't know. Police departments didn't know, because the advice to many organizations is to keep it quiet. I want to get your take on why many organizations that have had cyber attacks don't want to share this information. As a matter of fact, they strictly tell their employees not to share it.
Yeah, and that's certainly a concern, is like, especially when you're in the midst or kind of at the early stages of a cyber attack, there's concerns around disclosure and the potential liabilities associated with, you know, the types of data you've lost and the potential impacts. And so that's why initially, when an attack is typically occurring, you know, the guidance is to, you're going to be working very closely with external counsel, and they're going to be helping provide instruction and guidance on, like, hey, here's what you can say or what you can, you know, mention at this point in time. We can't necessarily go out there and publicly disclose all this information while we're still in the midst of an investigation. Now, I think where, to your point, we've gotten a lot better is there used to be this stigma associated with, we've had an incident. It's like, we've had an incident, we don't talk about it, we don't want to admit it, because that's going to be, you know, considered something that would be bad representation or bad for our brand. But nowadays, I think what we're recognizing is these types of things are happening to organizations of all sizes, of all budgets, across all verticals. And so now I think that we're learning, like, hey, what's better is to share our experiences so that we can help others address and combat those things. Yeah. And so I do think it's important to keep information during the middle of things close to your chest and kind of not share outside of what you're being told you can share. But then longer term, I think the idea is like, hey, let's all learn from each other's, you know, impacts and what we dealt with, so that we can help other people not have to deal with the same things in the future.
Real quick, Mark, we've talked about the idea that this could happen to any organization, but are there different certain types of organizations? Mm-hmm. We've mentioned maybe medical, that hackers tend to go after, or is it really just like they just spread the seeds of destruction around and see who kind of eats them up?
Yeah, like Anya mentioned, it really is dependent upon the cyber criminal group. We've got some groups that like to do, you know, big game hunting and target very large organizations or industries, and know that they, if they target manufacturing, that, you know, there's a high likelihood they can get paid. There's other groups that actually have within their kind of code or their affiliate terms that will say, hey, we specifically don't target hospital systems
or schools,
because
we
believe that's unethical. But then you've got other groups who've seen those as prime targets because of the sensitivity of the information, because the criticality of the infrastructure. So it really does vary. You've got a majority of groups that are more opportunistic in nature, which they're going to hit anybody. But then you've got others who very, very specifically do target certain types of industry.
I want to ask you, Anya, I get the sense, and I hope I'm wrong, that we've seen a lot of tremors in this space, but we haven't had the big earthquake yet, the big attack that really cripples an economy or maybe an infrastructure system. Do you have like a worst case scenario in mind, Anya, like sort of a scenario that you think could play out but hasn't played out yet, that could like really bring this issue to the forefront of our national security conversation?
It depends on who you think we are, but if we include Costa Rica, then we have already seen it with the Conti group deliberately targeting a country and wanting to paralyze its administration. And they were extremely successful in that. And it impacted a lot of people, particularly those on the poverty line, people who were waiting to be paid their wages, people wanting to access their healthcare. So it is possible. At the moment, President Putin is reining in his cyber troops, his freelance cyber troops, and there seems to be a code of honor among thieves that critical infrastructure won't be targeted. But I don't think we can rely on that necessarily holding.
But that is the worst case scenario, be going after like an electric grid, or would it be like an electric grid? Like, what would be sort of like the escalation?
Yeah. An airport
scenario? Like, what would that look like?
It could be anything, and it could start anywhere, and it could very easily spread from a power supply to drinking water, to hospitals. We've seen very big attacks that were spread randomly as part of ransomware, the WannaCry, the NotPetya attack. I think Ukraine has a lot of experience with things going really badly wrong in a lot of sectors at once, and they do fall like dominoes. So
it could be anything. And Mark, I see you nodding your head. You have anything to add there?
Yeah, I mean, within the last couple of weeks, I mean, I think that you have to take into account what the primary motivations of the different attackers are. Because today we're talking about ransomware, and we're talking about, you know, cyber criminal groups that are, you know, monetization is their primary motivation. You've got other groups that fall into the category of like hacktivism, where they're not driven by monetary motivations, they're driven by a certain cause. And then you've got like nation state or like advanced persistent threat groups, which are not monetized, they're motivated by like access to information. So if you step outside of ransomware, even within the last couple of weeks, because of some of the geopolitical tensions and things that have been occurring, we saw where Iranian-backed threat actors targeted an organization and completely wiped all of the employees' phones from that organization. There was no monetary gain. There was no release of information. It was strictly disruptive in nature. Yeah. So when we look at things like APT and nation states, electric grids, you know, those are the types of things that certainly could be targets. But I think you do need at the foundation, need to look at kind of what their primary motivation would be.
Yeah, let's bring in another caller. We have Sue from Princeton on the line. Sue, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I have a fair amount of medical appointments, and I find that, you know, I'll get the text message that says, please confirm your appointment, and then I click it. And then the first question that is asked is my birth date. And I think, how do I know this is not, how do I know it's safe to do? I just don't know. And I'm inclined now to stop accepting these notices from medical facilities.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I guess maybe, Mark, I would redirect that to say, because I don't know exactly what Sue is looking at or going through. But if you are a customer or a patient of a target system, are you a potential entry point? Or are they more looking at employees who would have greater access to systems as sort of like their wormhole into this?
Yeah, it varies. But when you're talking about ransomware holistically, typically you're looking at targeting people who are part of the organization because they would have access to infrastructure. They could then impact the infrastructure. Now, you've got different cyber criminal groups that are more about fraud and fraud related activities and not performing ransomware related campaigns, but they're focused on a different type of monetization and efforts that includes like fraud, where you are getting access to individuals and their accounts and trying to gain access, whether that's to tuition funds or payments or credit or anything like that. But more commonly, when you're talking about ransomware, it's going to be at the organizational level.
And as we get ready to wrap up, I have to ask this question because we had someone email in who talked about what can governments do, because I wonder if there should be some public policies in place to sort of get us to a point where we recognize this, where we make this staunchly illegal, and we have teams of people who are searching these folks out so that it doesn't ramp up. If each of you could briefly just say, are there policies we need to be looking at or pushing for as we see more and more ransomware attacks happen on our municipalities and corporations? And Anya, we'll start with you, and we have to keep it brief because we only have about 90 seconds left.
The problem is, it's a wicked problem. There are so many things that need to be done. The Ransomware Task Force came up with a list of 48 things that needed to be done, and there was no brief and easy solution. So what I would urge people to do is really to get on their own team and engage with their own cybersecurity. It's not something that you can outsource to the tech team, and it's certainly not something they can outsource to the government. But I would like to know what the government's plan B is when large parts of the infrastructure go down.
Yeah. And your thoughts, Mark?
Quickly, I would just say that, you know, I don't think we've had ideas around banning ransom payments. I think there's certain victim situations where they have a necessity or need to be able to pay it based on their ability to continue as a business. But we've also seen some positive, you know, efforts from certain law enforcement activities where they've taken down groups. We've seen where those get stood up very, very quickly. But putting in things like OFAC sanctions that say you can't pay certain groups because it's funding terrorism, we've seen where that has caused major disruption and they've had to disband or go do other things as well. So I do think we can see some, and we have seen recently some positive momentum, but I think there's still a lot of work to do.
Well, this was just a fascinating conversation. I didn't, my expectations were, it wasn't that I wasn't expecting it to be fascinating. I just didn't know what we were going to get into. And boy, is there a lot to get into with this topic. Oh my God. Anya Shortland is a professor at King's College in London, author of a forthcoming book called Dark Screens, Hackers and Heroes in the Shadowy World of Ransomware. Thank you, Anya, for your time today on Studio 2.
It was a fascinating conversation. Thank you.
And thanks also to Mark Lance, who is a ransomware negotiator at GuidePoint Security. Really appreciate the time, Mark.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me. I just say to everybody, stay vigilant. Be aware.
Stay vigilant.
Stay vigilant. And by the way, now it is time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Al, hit it.
One day I asked my teacher, what use is math to me? She answered, when you're older, someday, my boy, you'll see there's a world of computer systems out there full of valuable data and not secured with care. And you can make a fortune in ransomware with a little bit of math. It's called encryption, just a little bit of math.
What? Someone did. Someone found
a little bit of heads exploding in here. That's Ransomware Song. Just Blame Math by Forrest Brazil. It's a home recording uploaded to YouTube in 2021. EP Kev's quick research shows Forrest is a tech worker from North Carolina who dabbles in songwriting.
And a very, very well-deserved DJ of the day goes to someone who goes by DJ Manny 215. Thank you, DJ Manny, for nerding out on that song and being our DJ of the day. That is mighty impressive.
All right. And thank you, of course, to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copeson, Hazel May Bryan, Mike Schiffler, and Al Banks, engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Talk to you next week.